supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Every day, we make decisions that affect not just our lives and the lives of our families, but the lives of our community, the lives of our economy. Everything from purchasing a snack to a cup of coffee to whether or not to buy a car or a house. But with the economy in trouble and the constant flow of bad news, people have become afraid of what's going to happen. It's not only affected our decision-making, it's affected our brains, and then we in turn are affecting the economy. So we're going to discuss how we affect the economy today, the first of our two-part series. Next week we'll talk about how the economy affects us. Later on in the show we'll hear from Paul Zak. He is founder and director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies at Claremont University in California. His book is called Moral Markets, The Critical Role of Values in Our Economy. But first, we're joined on the telephone by Tim Kasser. Tim's an associate professor of psychology at Knox College, where he teaches, specializes in research on greed. He's the author of the book, The High Price of Materialism. And he's edited the book, The Psychology and the Consumer, I'll get that right, Consumer Culture. Tim Kasser, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And if you want to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about materialism and greed. So, Tim, it seems to me we've gotten into this mess, in my humble opinion, because of deep psychological impairment. We've developed blind faith in a system that is predatory, and those predators have become blind to everything but their own greed. Certainly we were not always impaired, or were we?
Well, I do think that if you take a look historically, there's always been cases of greed throughout what seems to be human history. I do think, though, that in our current situation, over the last 30 or 40 years, we have, as a society and as a group of individuals, have really had different attitudes about greed, if you will, than what you found in some past situations or past historical moments.
How so?
Pardon me?
How so?
Well, if you take a look, for example, at most religious or philosophical traditions, they tend to say that greed is problematic, or that we should avoid those kinds of materialistic desires. If you take a look, for example, at the Middle Ages, many of the basic sins that people talked about had something to do with materialism or consuming too much or being greedy.
Well, what are the numbers? 99% of the people in this country belong to one of those religions that advocate that. So what happened?
Well, I think what happened was our economic systems started to really shift in some really important ways in the 20th century as we embraced a different set of beliefs that weren't based on religion, but that instead had to do with capitalism and had to do with the primacy of financial profit, the primacy of economic growth, and the primacy of consumers being able to buy whatever it is that they want to buy. You know, our economic system, which in our writing we call American corporate capitalism, our economic system is one which is designed to maximize competition among people and to set loose the possibility of pursuing your own self-interest, to use the phrase that Adam Smith used when he first wrote about capitalism. And so what's happened over the years is that our governmental structures, our societal structures, and our own values within our own selves have also moved more and more towards these materialistic values because it's something which supports our economic system.
Okay, so this is how you describe American corporate capitalism. What about other forms of capitalism? Are they less likely to foment these problems, or is it capitalism itself that's the problem?
Well, I think both. I do think that there are certain aspects of capitalism as it is, compared to other economic systems which have existed over the ages, which are likely to encourage more materialistic values, more self-interested values, more competition. That said, because there are different forms of capitalism, you know, the kind of capitalism that's practiced in Scandinavia is pretty different than what you see of capitalism in the United States and in the United Kingdom, for example.
How so? How is it done in Scandinavia?
Well, in Scandinavia and in some of the other, especially northern European countries, the way that the economic system is set up is less about removing all government intervention and more about government involvement in the process. You know, here in the U.S. and in the U.K. as well, what we've witnessed over the last 30 or 40 years, since Reagan for sure, is a this idea that government is the problem and that markets themselves should be left as free as possible in order to solve the problems that society has. And so that's why we've seen privatization, that's why we've seen globalization, but especially privatization within a country, where everything is just turned over to the stock market or businesses or what have you.
Yeah, and we just heard on the news, you know, this talk about socializing banks as putting people into apoplexy. I mean, we just heard the Obama administration has squashed that idea. But I would imagine in the European countries, especially the northern ones, as you report, that would not put them into apoplexy.
No, because it's closer to what they already have. They have a more cooperative form where labor and capital and government all kind of work together in a more cooperative way to try to solve the problem of society. You know, America has a long and deep-seated concern about socialism and communism, and actually I'm reading Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States right now, and what's really fascinating about it is to see how much people were concerned about socialism communism in the 1880s and 1890s. And this has been a long-standing fear of Americans, if you will, because it's a fear which it's an economic system which proposes a different way of structuring society and a whole different set of values than the kind of capitalism that we have here.
Well, let me think out loud with you, if I may, Tim.
Sure.
You talk about fear, and I know what's happening now is driven by fear, and I know what fear does. You know, we look at the 2004 election, and that was driven solely by fear. There's a lot of fear that, I mean, you were talking about fear way back then, fear of communism. And what fear does is it has us close down, make our focus get smaller, and it makes us get self-absorbed. It's we versus they.
Well, the research very clearly supports that. I mean, first off, we know that threat is one of the main things that leads people to not like the other, to say that the other isn't as good as us. But we've also done studies that actually show that fear and threat promote materialistic values and actually lead people to become even more concerned about money and having a lot of possessions and things like that.
Because money gives us the illusion of security.
That's a big part of it, and because our society is one which reinforces that belief. Okay? It suggests to us that that is a good way to feel secure, is to become is to get money and is to have possessions.
Hmm.
But it's very clear from the literature that much of the time when people feel a sense of threat, a way that they try to cope with that is to orient towards the very materialistic values which are problematic and which sometimes create even more threat.
Well, I want to follow up on that. Let me just reintroduce you. We're talking with Tim Kasserys, he's an associate professor of psychology at Knox College and author of the book The High Price of Materialism. We're talking about greed and how our culture fosters it, foments it. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you if you feel that our economy has affected you, or if you have affected the economy. Do you feel that you've got a sense of greed inside because of all the advertising? Do you feel lost in what you thought you should have? And are you reorienting? Tell us what that's like for you. So I want to talk about something you said in the American Psychological Association Monitor, Tim. Mm-hmm. You said money and community are inherently incompatible because they tap into two fundamentally different motivational systems. They're incompatible?
Well, I think that really the best way to think of them is that it's very difficult to simultaneously pursue them at the same time, okay? Money and the concern for money and having possessions and having my own desires met is really about what Shalom Schwartz calls self-enhancing values, okay? It's really about me and what I want, and we know that the more focus people put on materialistic values, the more they report being narcissistic, they're less agreeable, less social, etc. Now, if you take a look at the way values are structured in people's minds, you can map that through a variety of statistical techniques into a circle so that you can see in this circle, it's called a circumplex, how different values are either psychologically consistent with each other or how they're in opposition to each other.
For example,
we find that people who tend to care a lot about money also tend to care a lot about their image, okay? And so, you know, if I say that I want to have a lot of money, I'm also likely to also say that it's important to me to have the right clothes or to have a big house or those other kinds of images.
So like in the old days when I was studying behavior therapy in its early days, we learned that anxiety and relaxation were incompatible. So
yes,
if you were
exactly
relaxed facing something that would have made you anxious, you can't be anxious.
And that's what we seem to find happens with material values and community values. So, for example, while caring about money and caring about image, so a circle has 360 degrees, right? Those values are only about 15 degrees apart. They're more or less on the same side of the circle. We find that caring about money and caring about being generous and trying to make the broader world a better place are 192 degrees in opposition.
Well, what about these very wealthy people who are extremely generous with their wealth and give back to the community?
Well, the first thing I would say is that wealth is not the same thing as being materialistic. Okay? Wealth is about what I have. Materialism is about what I want. So there are poor materialistic people, and there are rich materialistic people. There are poor people who don't care about money, and there are rich people who don't really care about
money. So the pursuit of great wealth is not necessarily incompatible with caring about the community.
Well, and sometimes great wealth just happens along the way. But it is extremely difficult to focus on them both at the same time. And take a look at a person like Bill Gates, okay? So Bill Gates oftentimes is held up as somebody who is a great philanthropist. But he wasn't while he was acquiring his wealth, okay? The whole time that he was really working hard on acquiring his wealth, he gave very little to charity as a relative percentage of his overall worth. And so it was difficult psychologically to both be in the place of figuring out how am I going to crush my competition and how am I going to end up benefiting humanity. Okay, those are different mindsets.
Yeah, they sure are. Let's see if we can get a call on before our break. We've got Olivia on the line. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is something I'm very passionate about. I've worked in the corporate world for many years, and I'm kind of a spiritual seeker, and I see this big disconnect with what people are going after in business. And I've actually just written a book on holistic business practices, but I just actually came back from India also, where we visited some businesses, and they seem to have what they call kind of another element, that is this desire to do good, to feed the community, and almost like Peter Senge talked about the fifth discipline, personal mastery, and that there's very little cheating or stealing. You know, people are there and they do their best, and it's just a completely different model. It's much more holistic, and I think that that is something that's missing in business today. If I can mention a movie, The Corporation is a really good look at what we have going on globally that I think is kind of undermining social values in general, because businesses aren't built on a holistic model. They're built to just, like you said, make money and be greedy, and beneath that are people, I think, with those same values. So that's my comment.
Well,
can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think that you're right. You know, and by it is not the case that businesses, any one business, always has to focus just on profit. I think that there are lots of organizations and models of organizations which are able to inject other values into the way that they operate in order to do things other than just try to make a profit. You know, so for example, you can take a look at the example of cooperatives. Take a look at the values that cooperatives try to work towards. It has a lot to do with these kind of holistic things and with trying to benefit the community and with giving their members a lot of freedom, et cetera, which is not what corporations are designed to do. But we have to recognize that part of why corporations act the way they do is because the legal structure of the United States forces them to. I mean, the laws in the U.S., up until the 1880s, said that corporations had to try to make a profit, publicly traded corporations had to try to make a profit, and they needed to do good for their community. But in the 1880s and 1890s, that last set of values was taken out. Okay, and now the sole purpose legally of a publicly traded corporation is to make as much profit for shareholders as possible.
I want to broaden out the question. Olivia, thanks so much for your call. We define a healthy economy in this country as looking at things like GDP, leading economic indicators, market, consumer confidence. But what about other economies? Do they look at other indicators for a successful economy?
Well, there are other economies that have begun to do that. So, for example, a very small nation that many people haven't heard of is the Kingdom of Bhutan, which is over by Nepal in the Himalayas. And they've given up the idea of maximizing gross domestic product, and they're trying to maximize what they call gross national happiness, which has a whole different set of indicators than what feeds into GDP. There are other nations, so France has just begun an effort in order to use some ideas to have different indicators feed into their national policy making other than just GDP. I've spent a fair bit of time in the UK over the last couple of years, and there are some very active debates in the UK government about directly measuring well-being, how to best incorporate ecological and social outcomes into national members or measures of progress, etc. So there are quite a number of models out there for other ways to measure how not just our economy is doing, but how our society is doing.
To underscore the difficulty, Tim, we did a show a couple of years ago about corporations and their mentality. And we had a man who was the CEO of a publicly traded multinational corporation. And I brought up these issues, like well-being, like happiness, like community. And he said, you've got to understand something. And he said, basically, I'm being naive. He said, we live quarter by quarter.
Yes.
And he said, because I'm publicly traded, he said, I've got to meet the number. I've got to hit the number every quarter that Wall Street tells me to hit. And if I don't hit that number, I'm failing and I could lose my job. And of course, after that show, we found out that those numbers from Wall Street simply depend on who's in bed literally or metaphorically with who.
Right.
But, you know, he said, I don't have time to deal with well-being.
Well, and if well-being stands in the way of those quarterly profits, then he, by law, has to decide in favor of quarterly profits over well-being. That's what he must do, because his job is to maximize shareholder wealth.
Right. By the way, since we've spoken, he has lost his job, and the company has virtually turned into penny stock, which is no great surprise. We've got to take a break, and we're going to move on and talk with Paul Zak. But I've got one last question for you.
Okay.
You got a call from Larry Summers, or President Obama, and he wants you to run their economic team.
Okay.
So fix it for us.
How long do I have to talk here?
I'll give you 90 seconds.
90 seconds to fix, given the situation we're in right now.
Yeah, you've got all the power.
I've got all the power. Okay, well, the first thing I'd do would be to change the indicators in the way that we just described. There's lots of good models out there that you can use. The second thing, which would be unpopular among businesses, would be that I would bring in some revenue by taxing advertisements. Right now, advertisements are actually a write-off. We could start taxing them and generate a good deal of revenue. I think we have to recognize that much of the current stimulus package is actually designed to maximize consumption at many different levels, and I think that that's not the strategy that we need to be pursuing right now, especially given environmental problems. I think there are other ways to get people back to work, to protect people's homes, et cetera, that would be more like, you know, the CCC and the WPA and all of the great arts programs that happened back during the Depression that we could begin to implement, rather than relying on tax cuts and trying to build more roads that people are going to drive on and put more carbon into the air, et cetera.
Well, Tim, if you've got some extra time in your schedule, I'll give the president a call.
So well, if you've got contacts, I'm willing to talk to him.
Yeah, it makes all the sense in the world to me. Thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk with Paul Zak, who's the founder and director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies at Claremont University in California. How interesting is that? We're talking about the economy, of course, and we're talking about how we affect the economy and how the economy affects us. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY and announces two new degree programs, BS in Physics and PhD in Cell and Molecular Biology. The Physics undergrad program has biophysics and materials science tracks for careers in the emerging science of the 21st century. The PhD in Cell and Molecular Biology enables students to work with genes and proteins to help solve real-world problems. More about these programs at usp.edu.
Tomorrow, it's an NPR News special, President Obama's address to Congress. Join host Melissa Block for live, in-depth coverage, including analysis from NPR White House and congressional correspondents and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republican response to the president's speech by Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. That's tomorrow, an NPR News special, President Obama's address to Congress.
Tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking, I guess like everybody else is, we're talking about the economy, but the relationship between the economy and our minds, how we affect the economy and how the economy affects us. We're joined now by Paul Zak. He's a founder and director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies at Claremont University. His new book is called Moral Markets, The Critical Role of Values in the Economy. Paul, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Dan. Thank you so much for having me.
That's really an interesting background you've got. Your training is in neurobiology, and you're a professor of economics. What got you thinking about bridging that gap?
Frustration.
Really?
Yeah. I was working on why countries are poor or rich, and I found I really couldn't answer that question well enough with the kind of economic models that existed. And so I started building these models of human behavior based on biology, and I found that led me into this discovery of the role of trust, and trust is one of the primary factors, levers, that promote prosperity around the world. So when trust is high, transactions, economic transactions occur, and wealth is created, and living standards go up.
Well, yeah, and I believe the hormone is called oxytocin.
That's right. That's so my lab discovered the role of oxytocin at facilitating trust between strangers, trust in a tangible way involving money, So you have money and you can give it to somebody else to invest for you. And it turns out that when someone does that, your brain releases oxytocin. And we discovered that this hormone, which is classically associated with care for offspring and bonding to those around us, makes us care about individuals in a real tangible way. That is, when people's brains release oxytocin, they were much more likely to reciprocate the money that was entrusted to them.
That's interesting. I also know from other studies about oxytocin that if you experience simple compassion by someone else, if they make eye contact and really want to hear your story, it releases oxytocin in both.
Exactly. And even more than that, we've shown recently in the last year that oxytocin, in fact, makes us generous towards strangers, so that when our oxytocin is stimulated, we're much more likely to share with another person. So we see this now kind of tight circle between what is happening in the economy, you know, that many economic transactions rely on trust, rely on reciprocity, because there's not Big Brother or a policeman overlooking every transaction. And indeed, that motivates us not only to reciprocate, to be good customers or business people, but in fact to be more generous. So I thought it was really great that you chose two really polar points in the view. My colleague Tim Kasser, I think, is trotting out the party line, hasn't thought deeply about these issues at all. And in fact, all economic transactions require morality.
You have said that every decision we make ultimately is economic. It involves trade-offs, risks.
That's right. In fact, every biological system is economic, in that we have a scarce amount of resources, and we have goals that we want to try to reach with those resources. So biological systems, animals are very economic. They try to conserve resources and obtain them when they're available. Choosing a marriage partner is economic. We want to figure out if this guy or girl is appropriate, or should I wait and look for another one? And there are certainly family income issues as well.
So animals are good at this. You've said in your writing that the oldest parts of our brains aren't evolved enough for the fast-paced financial world, but it's unlikely that we're going to go back to the barter system. So what can we do to get our brains in better shape?
I don't think our brains are getting better shape, but I think having an understanding of the brain allows us to work with our strengths and try to avoid our weaknesses in terms of decision-making. So our brain certainly did not evolve for the very fast-paced, 24-hour news cycle, immediate information situation we're in now. And so what we find in neuroeconomic studies is that this kind of inflames areas in the brain associated with emotions, for example, fear or greed or pain. And when these are highly activated, we, in a very unconscious sense, sometimes a visceral sense, react in ways and make decisions that are against our long-term best interests.
So, you know, I practice meditation, so I understand reactivity, that stimulus on the outside can produce an instantaneous internal reaction. But in today's world, and you seem to be saying this, our brains can't seem to distinguish between a mastodon and the news on CNN.
Right. So, I mean, one implication of that is to turn off CNN and, you know, listen to WHIY, read the newspapers, and slow down decisions. So there's this tension between using rules and using discretion. And I think this is a time, particularly in volatile economic times, when rules should trump discretion, because our discretion is so influenced by what happened to me this morning or the news I read. And I think when you have more thoughtful, deliberative kind of conversations like we're having now, then we can better make decisions that are based on those deliberative but slower parts of our brains. We have to take some time to make these decisions.
Interesting. All right, let's take a phone call. We've got Peter on the line. Peter?
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Peter.
How are you?
What can we do for you?
Good. I just wanted to make a comment. I couldn't agree more with your current guest. I'm in the investment business, and not just your typical stocks and bonds. And I find that in many cases it comes down to emotions and dealing with people and their emotions. Several forces drive markets, greed and fear. Right now there's a lot of negativity. We're not facing a plague. We're not going to stop, and the world's going to stop, and we're going to fall off. People are talking about a depression. It's not 1932. We do have a Fed. Obama's passed the largest stimulus package in history, and we need to give it a chance. And I think your guest is absolutely right. We all expect a McDonald minute. We want it to turn around, and we're very short-sighted.
Well, my
question is, you know, for those people who are in the business, for those people who deal with it day to day, whether it's in the investment business, you know, I turn off CNN and CNBC. I don't watch them, and I couldn't agree with your guest more. You know, what types of suggestions do you have for people who are in the business, who really do a good business and long-term planning with their clients? How do you approach something like that?
Let me piggyback on top of that question, Paul. The question, as I hear Peter asking, is how do you help clients? How do I help my clients even take a look at the bigger picture? That it's not a mastodon. It's problems, but you know we're going to get our meals today, and you know there's a big picture out there. How does that get done?
I think there's kind of two answers to that. One is the kind of acute answer, which is kind of what do I do right now to make myself feel better? And I think that has to do with understanding that, as you know, Dan, that oftentimes personal growth requires some pain. It requires a response to some traumatic event. So economists talk about the cleansing effect of recessions. Recessions kind of call out the weak businesses. They identify inefficiencies in the economy that we wouldn't find otherwise, in fact, in government as well. So it's a chance to kind of regroup and ask, what's our core principles? What makes us as happy as possible? I think this is an opportunity to do the same thing for us as individuals, to say, hey, do I really need that big fancy car? Do I really need this? What makes me happy? What are the relationships in life that make me happy? What are the aspects that I really need? Should I spend more time with my children? Should I spend more time with my spouse and friends? And I think that translates over directly into the caller's question on how we approach clients. So if this recession is like most other recessions, and a year from now things will be looking much brighter. And I think it's relating that to clients that, yes, this is a deep recession. It's about as deep as the recession 81, 82. And what happened after that? We had a really very strong period, one of the longest expansions in U.S. history in the 1980s. So it's a time to actually rebuild, regroup, and from a customer service perspective, you want to connect to people on what they need to feel comfortable.
Peter, thanks so much for your call. You do bring up an important issue. It's, you know, back to the issue of brains. I see in my clinical practice, Paul, that the problem with resilience is people tend to remember clearly how many times they've been knocked down or injured or traumatized. But they don't remember clearly that every one of those times they've gotten back up and been fine, thank you, and sometimes even better. But there's something about our brain that doesn't register.
Well, it's because we're in this sort of survival mode now. So we've lost a lot of resources, most of us have. And as long as your time horizon to retire, for example, is 5 years or less, it's longer than 5 years, just hang on. You know, this is the time not to change course and just stick with the plan, and understanding that the economy has cycles. So I think, yeah, that resilience is what we see in the economy. Without stress, we don't grow. It's like building your muscles, like working out. If you don't stress the muscles, they won't grow. If you don't stress your cardiovascular system, you don't become healthier. So I think this is a time to really get to our own individual psychological health or economic health, and even our spiritual health.
That's interesting. We're talking with Paul Zak, who is a neuroeconomist, and his book is Moral Markets, The Critical Role of Values in the Economy. Let's take a call before we go to break. We've got Chris on the line. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my request is to have your guest discuss the Quaker example of modified capitalism. All of the Quaker families from the history I've read became, not all of them, but many of them became wealthy. They ran very successful businesses in Philadelphia and the Philadelphia area, yet they practiced profit sharing with all their employees at the end of the year. And the obvious, from the stories I hear, including someone I know worked for such a company, they were much more motivated. They felt respected and appreciated. And instead of having the syndrome of that's not my job with certain tasks at work, they approached everything with everything is part of my job, even picking up trash. Since the better this company is run, the more income I can earn. Please comment on that.
Thanks for your call, Chris. Paul?
That's a wonderful example, Chris, of the kind of cooperative mode that's required in decentralized modern economies. So there is a win-win solution for everybody, where the employees get what they want, business owners are getting a return on their capital, customers are getting treated well, and the companies that do that survive in the long term because everyone's incentives are aligned in the same direction. It's the companies that get a lot of press, the Enrons, the Tycos, that are run purely on greed that don't survive. So if you want to live in the long term, if you want to survive in the long term as a business and actually have healthy, productive, psychologically intact employees, that's the kind of model you want to use. Great example.
We're going to have to take a break, Paul. We're going to come back in 60 seconds and talk more. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the stock market, why it swings, and maybe you've got some ideas for some investments while we're chatting. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking with Paul Zak, a neuroeconomist at Claremont University in California. His book is called Moral Markets, The Critical Role of Values in Our Economy. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM, Philadelphia.
Like so many great rock musicians, songwriter Grant Hutchinson of Frightened Rabbit is obsessed with writing about heartache.
It was really just because it was the most important thing that was happening to me at the time. I think that's why everyone does it. And because I can't think about anything else, and I can't write about anything else, because it's actually all I can think about.
I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kotz.
And this week on Sound Opinions, we welcome the lovesick Scottish band Frightened Rabbit.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
The birth of octuplets to a California woman through in vitro fertilization has placed fertility clinics under new scrutiny. On the next Fresh Air, how multiple births are affecting parents, society, and the babies themselves. We talk with journalist Liza Mundy, author of the book Everything Conceivable. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about the economy, how it affects us, how we affect it. We're talking with Paul Zak, who's founder and director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies at Claremont University in California. So, Paul, you know, we've established that our brains get agitated, that they get stressed, that they don't calm down. Even when the environment calms down a bit, it's almost as though our brains have hijacked our minds, or vice versa. You know, that we are not perceiving the reality of what's going on outside. It's so mediated by our agitated brain, so that when we're overreacting, we don't know we're overreacting. We think we're being rational.
Right. So that's the greatest justification for more NIH funding for brain research, is that we actually don't know how our brain works. So perhaps 99% of what our brain does is outside our conscious awareness. So as we do this research and understand that we have these tendencies, biases, and behave in certain ways, I think we can, again, kind of put a check on that and slow things down.
Is this why the stock market swings so wildly, like Peter said, fear and greed?
That's one of the primary reasons. Also, you know, we're a herd creature, and so there have been some interesting studies recently that have activated this kind of reward area of the brain. In one really interesting study, they showed heterosexual men pictures, pornographic pictures, then had them make financial decisions that depended on risk. And men who saw these pornographic pictures relative to neutral pictures took on much more risk. So you activate these areas of the brain that says, get these rewards, and then we have two problems. We're taking more risk on, and then we see everyone else doing it, and we follow that. So this kind of risk-seeking behavior and herding behavior produces these swings in the stock market.
So I'm interested Could you tell us briefly about the three kinds of animals in the market? Bulls, bears, and pigs.
Bulls, bears, and pigs. That's right. So the bulls think the market will keep going up, and the pigs think the market's going down, and the pigs get slaughtered. So what you don't want to do is to be a pig. So again, if you have a 401k plan or a retirement plan in which you are consistently investing a certain amount of money every month for your retirement, that's something you should stick with. So now the pigs are the ones who are pulling out of the market and are losing, you know, 30 or 40%. But if you stay in the market, again, as long as your horizon is 5 years or more, then this is the time to actually keep investing, because every dollar you invest now, for example, in the stock market index, which will go up over time, is going to give you more stock. So it's actually a good time. So
right.
It's called dollar cost averaging. So stick with the plan. Don't let your primitive emotions of fear overtake your rational thoughts.
So before we go to the callers, I'm going to put you on the spot. Have you been buying stock?
I have been buying stock. There's some enormous bargains right now. So I think this is the time. If you have a taste for risk and you're not going to lose sleep over it. If you're losing sleep over it, not a good idea. I'm sure you tell your clients that all the time.
Right.
And your horizon is long enough. 5 years or longer, yes, this is the time to buy.
Let's go to the calls. And callers, do not ask Paul what stocks he's buying. I'll do that after the show.
Okay.
We'll get back to you. We've got Ed on the line.
Ed. Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, I've gone through a few rounds of layoffs, and luckily I've not been touched. But I've also picked it up at work and have done that. But I also have two boys that are 14 and 11 from a first marriage, and now my new wife and I discover we're actually expecting twins. And my oldest and my two boys are somewhat spoiled, and luckily for them, their mom has the financial means to do that. But in our home, I really don't have it. And I'm curious to know what kind of opportunities, other than, we're obviously reshaping how we do things and how we spend money at home. And, the boys have chores and they need to learn how to earn the right to, in my opinion, to have an allowance and go and spend money. But how do we as parents take on this recession as an opportunity to reteach our children what's really important as far as family and spending time with one another and not worrying about getting the latest and greatest Xbox game or new pair of shoes?
Well, it's a great question. I think you have partially answered it, and I guess the rest of the answer is through role modeling. Paul, what do you have to say about Ed's question?
I agree completely. I think, first of all, congratulations on the twins. That's
yeah.
Really exciting. It's a great opportunity to actually work with your children, as I have done. I have little children. And teach them that other people are suffering, they're in pain, and we have an opportunity to help them, and how valuable that is, and also the value of hard work, that nothing comes for free. And so I think you're doing exactly the right thing.
Yeah, and you know, we in the mental health field know that less is more, and more raises anxiety. There's plenty of research about that more raises anxiety. Ed, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call. We've got Valerie on the line. Valerie, hi, you're on the air. We lost Valerie.
I'm looking at this from a really different point of view, which is that I have a career development counseling practice and have had it for 20 years. And what's really interesting to me is that people now who are looking for jobs, what I have been telling people for a long, long time is that you have to really be mindful of the way that you look for a job, that you can't grab at things and let your anxiety just drive you, but that you have to do what the man that you're talking about is talking to is saying, which is to be as clear and as conscious of the way that you're looking for a job so that the job that you get also is healthy. And I think that helps to drive the economy too, that people are getting good, healthy jobs and not going from one job to the next.
Valerie, you know, what you're saying sounds great, but it also sounds theoretical. Give us an example. What do you mean? Valerie? Oh, I think we lost Valerie. I think it's great in principle, you know, but how do we be mindful when looking for jobs. What does that mean? Do you know?
Yeah, I think part of that is, you know, looking at the mission of the company. You know, there are really interesting companies like eBay, who has a motto of "Do the right thing." That sounds like a company I want to work for. Also, I think, you know, we're very good at picking up people's kind of micro emotions, micro expressions, and when you're interviewing for a job, we realize that people who are lying or telling the truth, you know, we can pick that up. We have a sort of gestalt sense of that. And that also requires that the interviewee, you have to be honest, you have to be authentic and say, hey, I really want to be in a place that's not going to make me work 100 hours a week. I want to have a life. I have a family. And I think honesty is very important, particularly now.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Mary on the line. Mary,
hello?
Yes, hi, Mary.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I'm really surprised at the elitist tone that this show is taking.
How so?
As if you believe that the majority of people have the luxury to go work for a company like eBay or to restructure their stocks and bonds and really be thoughtful about it. And my husband had to close a business this past week with his business partner, and it was a grueling decision. And we had to lay 30 people off in Philadelphia alone, and it's not over yet. And I think for someone to say that they just have to have a positive attitude and to say that any business that's not surviving these days is a greedy one. I'm really shocked at the elitist tone that the show is taking.
Well, Mary, I'm not so sure that's exactly what we're saying. Hold on. Let me hear Paul react to that, and I've got my own thoughts.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And Mary, we certainly understand the pain you're going through, and most of us have been laid off at businesses. It's not pleasant. But I think, you know, there are forces outside us that sometimes affect how one business is run, the overall economy, also internal forces. And again, I think it's very painful to face these traumatic decisions, but on the other hand, we have to kind of move on and move forward. I think that's what the show's about. But Dan, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, the other factor is, you know, Mary, I would never dare say anything like that to you and your husband or their employees, because you're in crisis right now. You've just been through a trauma, a terrible trauma, one that, frankly, I can't fathom right now. And I can't imagine the emotions that you're going through. The last thing I would ever say to someone like you is, you know, get the big picture. You know, there's a Sufi saying that I quote very often, you know, when the heart weeps for what it's lost, the soul rejoices for what it's found. But first you have to weep. I mean, you've got to go through a period of mourning and go through what anybody who's traumatized has to go through. My heart goes out to you and your husband and the rest of the employees. And you know what? If there is an elitist tone to the show, there may well be. And if so, I apologize for that. But moreover, I am sorry for you and your husband. Okay.
And the employees that have to go out there and beat the pavement
today.
Yeah,
of course.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Thank you.
So we do have to have that perspective, Paul, you know.
That was a very good comment. Exactly right. It's easy for us to have jobs to say, oh, you can do it better, hang in there. But, yeah, there are a large number of people who are, in fact, unemployed and are just trying to survive.
So I'm going to ask you a variation on the question I asked Tim Kasser earlier. How would you advise the administration to help us get out of this mess, to help us recalibrate our brains and our way of thinking about money?
Well, I think, you know, the wonderful election of President Obama has given people a sense of hope, but I don't think we should be in this I feel like there's a sort of adolescent whiny mode out here, like, oh, just solve it now and throw money at the problem. Recessions are very important. They're economic growth opportunities. They're personal growth opportunities. I think we have to kind of embrace that we had a very long expansion, and we're going to have to do some retrenching. It's going to be painful. And it's a time to reach out and help our neighbors. And I think, you know, all the history we know, particularly in the 20th century, suggests that throwing money at the problem really is throwing good money at bad. GM's been going out of business for 20 years, taking taxpayer money and throwing at that, I think,
The big question, though, is how do we do that? I mean, you can see what's happening in Washington. Now we'll talk about GM. You know damn well they're going to throw more money at that. They're not going to turn their backs. And that's about anxiety. It's about politics. You know, nobody in politics is going to be able to stand up and say to their people who vote for them, well, we're just going to have to let this wash through and recalibrate our lives and our system.
I agree with you. I think there's a disconnect between, you know, what's appropriate economically and even individually psychologically and what politicians want to do. But I don't think we should sit there with our hands out, because there's a slippery slope. I live in a very small town in California, and the car dealer said, oh, we don't want to pay our taxes for the next 3 years because we want to bail out. Well, okay, so you don't pay the taxes now. The city doesn't have as much money to take care of parks and police. So I think we have to hang in. This is time to just hang on to the airplane and let it get through the turbulence.
You're talking about faith here, which relates back to our original discussion about oxytocin.
I think it's about faith and hope, and really love, for that matter. We have to show some love to the people around us and show some gratitude for those of us who have jobs and help the people who don't.
Well, that's what you were implying throughout the show when you say, think about what's important. The issue really is about love, and we do know that when we are able to love who we love better and love more people, that releases oxytocin and that helps develop faith. And that really is what it's about, ultimately, when we can stop and think about it. Paul Zak, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure to be on, Dan. Thank you so much.
Paul Zak is director of the Center for Neuroeconomic Studies at Claremont Graduate School in California. Early on, we heard from Tim Kasser. He is an associate professor of psychology at Knox College, where he specializes in research on greed. He's written The High Price of Materialism. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll talk about what the economy does to us, how it affects marriage, depression, so on and so forth. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of radio content here at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Gita Simons and Elisa Walters. Our new intern and researcher par excellence is Jonathan Glick. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Please enjoy your week, my friend.